It's a Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This weekend, the Pennsylvania Democratic leadership held its winter meeting in Hershey. While the Democratic National Convention coming to Philadelphia in 2016 has been great news on the national front, here in the Commonwealth, there could be a rift in the leadership of the state's Democratic Party. What could this mean for Pennsylvania politics? I'm joined now by phone from Harrisburg by Charles Thompson, who covers state government for the Patriot News. Charles Thompson, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello there.
As the Democrats convened in Hershey over the weekend, they had things to be feeling upbeat about, like wooing next year's national convention and Tom Wolf's taking over as governor, which is his tenure still in the honeymoon stage. But below the surface, there seems to be some sort of rift developing. What can you tell us about it?
Well, I think the apparent rift is residue from the 2014 governor's race, where a lot of times the gubernatorial candidate sort of gets to name the party committee chairman for the state Democratic committee. And, the organization sort of becomes the governor's political offshoot. And last year, the sitting state Democratic committee chairman, Jim Byrne of Allegheny County, did not want to relinquish that post. And then you saw Wolf's forces form their own political action committee called Fresh Start PA that sort of served as an alternative to the Democratic state committee. And, it sort of created two tracks for party activism. And that led some people to sort of believe that there might be some sort of an attempt to oust Jim Byrne at this winter meeting. And in fact, it really did not materialize. And I'd have to say that nobody really seemed to want to talk about it. They were all focused on the positives that you mentioned at the outset. There was a glow from Pennsylvania landing the National Presidential Nominating Convention in 2016 for Philadelphia, and Wolf taking office. And, they also touted their state success in statewide races in 2012, in the Auditor General and Attorney General and Treasurer races, though, nobody dared mention on Saturday that two of those three row officers are in serious legal trouble right now. But it was an era of good feeling on Saturday, surprisingly, out of all the snow and everything.
Well, people are more likely to talk about the good that's going on and want to keep any kind of ill feelings below the surface, but they are there nonetheless. Before we get to some of the things that are happening with those statewide office holders that won office in 2012, there is this issue with the party chairman, Jim Byrne. Why does Governor Wolf have an issue with him? What is the reason for him seemingly wanting to, if not to oust him, to kind of push his role to more of a back burner role in what's currently going on for Democrats in Harrisburg?
Well, I have to say I'm not necessarily sure of the origin of any reason for why Governor Wolf, has any antipathy toward Chairman Byrne, and I'm not even sure that he does. But I just know that traditionally, Democratic standard bearers have had the right to sort of name those party executives, and Wolf, Wolf comes from a bit of a different environment. He's not a career politician in the sense that he spent a lot of time in the electoral politics environment. He hasn't been a member of party committees for a long time and that sort of thing. He kind of came into the structure as a member of, and a supporter of Governor Rendell and a member of Governor Rendell's cabinet. And so you know, I think he was just looking to name his own team. And, you know, as we've seen, as he's built his administration, he is leaning heavily on some of the one-time rivals that he had from, one-time partners who became rivals temporarily in the Democratic gubernatorial primary, talking about people that served alongside him in the Rendell administration in the cabinet, John Hanger and Katie McGinty, who are now his director of policy and chief of staff, respectively. And, you know, as Wolf drew those folks close after his primary win, I think he just seemed to feel like it was more feasible to let them run a separate operation under Fresh Start. I think there's been concerns about the effectiveness of the Democratic State Committee also, because in past elections, they haven't exactly batted 1,000 when it comes to electing endorsed candidates. That said, I mean, certainly the Supreme Court candidates were anxious. They were in there pitching on Saturday and anxious to get endorsements for 2015.
Right. But, I want to get into some of that, the opportunity that the Democrats seem to have with the possibility of gaining control of the state Supreme Court. You mentioned Tom Wolf. It's interesting how that happens. You know, you have these political rivals of the two of the people that he was running for, you know, governor against, at least for the Democratic nomination, John Hanger, right, as you mentioned, and Katie McGinty, now part of his administration. There are those old guard Democrats, you know, Bob Casey, Ed Rendell, and even Governor Wolf. They are the senior leaders of the party, but apparently none of those three were on hand over the weekend. Is that correct?
Yeah, and that may be another reason why nobody was, you know, there just was no momentum for any kind of a coup, because what you had was, I think, you know, there were some what you might call second-tier Democratic leaders. You had Lieutenant Governor Stack, Auditor General DePasquale, Mayor of Allentown, Senator Costa from Pittsburgh, the Senate Minority Leader. So there were Democratic leaders there, but the room of 340 state committee members was packed with committee chairs and people who are active at grassroots level politics in counties across Pennsylvania, and frankly, that's kind of the wheelhouse for Chairman Byrne. He's still pretty popular among folks within the party structure. It would take an effort from some of the big guns in the Democratic Party, probably like Rendell and Casey and Wolf, of course, to actually mount a challenge if they decide they want to do it. And if they decide they want to do it, I think that would probably now be a matter for, summer meeting in June, as they gear up for, you know, the fall campaign season ahead. But you know what? I mean, it'll be interesting to see if there are attempts to mend fences internally over these next 3 or 4 months. I think there's an opportunity to do that because of the afterglow from the convention. I mean, I'm sure that Democrats in Pennsylvania would like to be rowing in the same direction, and you know, for that big national party coming here, and so we'll see.
Well, you know,
there may also be just a question of whether, you know, Governor Wolf may really feel like it's not a battle he needs to fight, because, you know, he's able to raise money on his own as an incumbent governor, and you know, he can run his own campaign without too much help from the Democratic Party structure at this point.
We're talking with Charles Thompson from Harrisburg. He covers state government for the Patriot News and PennLive.com. If you have a comment or question, you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM. You can tweet your questions at ESSPGH. Charles, how much is the legal trouble for the bright stars of the party, the surprise resignation of former state treasurer Rob McCord, who looked like he might be destined for higher office, and the scandal involving Attorney General Kathleen Kane, who allegedly leaked secret grand jury information in an effort to discredit a political enemy? How much is all that weighing on the Pennsylvania Democratic Party, maybe weighing them down a little bit? Is anybody in the party still thinking about Kane being a good challenger to Senator Toomey in 2016?
No, I'd be surprised if that's the case. I mean, she's kind of in survival mode right now, the way it looks from my desk. And I think that, you know, they're probably having to hit a reset button to try and find a good candidate to match up against Toomey. In recent days, you started to hear actually one of Kane's antagonists from within the party, Philadelphia District Attorney Seth Williams, his name has sort of hit the grapevine as a potential candidate. I think he'd like to get a little more involved in statewide politics, so that might be a name to watch. I believe former Congressman Sestak, who has run for, he ran against Spector the last time that Spector, Arlen Spector ran for election in Pennsylvania.
I believe he lost.
Right. I believe that he's made noise about throwing his hat in the ring again as well. But, less attractive.
Charles, let me jump in.
He's in survival mode.
Is Joe Sestak? I mean, he has already run and lost for U.S. Senate. Is he viewed as a strong candidate at this point? I mean, isn't there a push among Democrats to maybe find someone to take his place?
Yeah, sure. I don't know that he would necessarily be viewed as a super strong candidate. I mean, I think that's the main impact it has on the Democrats. It's not that people look at the recent guilty plea by Treasurer McCord and perhaps a leak of grand jury information. If Kathleen Kane ever would be charged with that, I don't think people would look at that and say, that means all Democrats are corrupt, or for some reason Governor Wolf, who's come out pretty strongly with some strong pro-ethics stances in the early days of his administration. I don't think it tars him directly, but the effect is that, you know, here's, you know, these guys had been sort of positioning themselves as, you know, giving the Democrats the ability to build a deep bench for future races, and their implosions are kind of taking themselves out of that mix, and it kind of leaves a vacuum for, okay, so who do we want to rally behind for a U.S. Senate seat? The reason that's a little less of a worry for the Democrats in the state right now is because they have a brand new governor who has the prospect of, you know, 4 years ahead of him, and maybe if he can reverse the Corbett curse, a second term as governor. So they're good to go in Harrisburg. You know, what they need to concentrate on is trying to win more local elections to try and get a better balance of power in the state Senate and state House for Wolf. I would say those would be big concerns for the Democrats. And this year, you know, another thing that they can certainly try and shoot for is to try and get a majority on the Supreme Court.
What kind of opportunity do the Democrats have to control the state Supreme Court?
Well, it's just a matter of, I guess they've got to go. The court is effectively 2-2 with one Republican incumbent seeking a new 10-year term, and that's Justice Corey Stevens, and then two vacancies at the moment. So of the three seats that are going to be on the ballot for us all this year, whoever wins two of the three seats there will take control. It's the court's 3-2 in the hands of the Republicans right now. That includes Justice Stevens. So, if the Democrats win two of the seats that are up for election this year, they could get a 4-3 majority on the court if the Republicans keep Stevens and claim one of the other seats, then they would have that 4-3 majority. And, you know, the justices would blanch at this kind of talk because they like to say that, you know, they're following the law in their decisions. But the fact of the matter is we elect them through the political party mechanisms. And you know, that means that you're getting judicial candidates that do bring a certain philosophy to the bench, and that can color their interpretations of the laws. So you bet, you know, both parties are going to make a major effort to try to get that fourth seat this year.
And as we wrap this up, Charles, what is the long-range plan for the Democrats as far as you can see leading up to the Democratic National Convention? They will have a chance to really raise their profile in the state with this event coming and the fact that there will be a Democratic governor in place when it does happen. What is the thinking as the Democrats sort of, eye that prize?
Well, because I can't read the tea leaves for Rendell or Wolf or Casey on this matter or any of the other Democratic titans because they weren't there on Saturday. But my gut would tell me that there would be an effort at some kind of détente to see if, you know, the governor may look at Jim Byrne and the Democratic State Committee and let's see if you can, you can get a good structure together and we can have some, let's see if we can mount a good effort to win these Supreme Court races and concentrate on that and see if we can get a good candidate or encourage good candidates to emerge for the 2016 Senate race. And, I think they'll evaluate how that goes through the spring. And you know, what I don't know is the conversations that those guys might be having about. But I mean, I think they're going to let things ride for a little while, and see how it goes this year, and then, you know, maybe address it. At the beginning of 2016.
Charles Thompson covers state government for the Patriot News and also PennLive.com. He was at the Democratic Leadership's winter meeting in Hershey over the weekend. Charles Thompson, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we'll hear about a medical adhesive created here in Pittsburgh that could revolutionize surgeries around the world. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Cohera Medical Incorporated is a good example of Pittsburgh's meds and eds economy. The Northside Company recently received FDA approval for its internal surgical adhesive. Cohera Medical President and CEO Patrick Daly joins us now in Studio A to explain the product's potential to revolutionize surgeries. Patrick Daly, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
Hey, Paul. Great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Explain what tissue glue is exactly and what its intended use is. How does it work?
Sure. Tissue glue is the first ever degradable synthetic adhesive for use inside the body. So when this when we started the company about 8.5-9 years ago, there's been a big void in the medical community. There's been topical adhesives, and there's a product called Fibrin Sealants, which can be used inside the body.
And these are used for what purpose? In other words, if somebody has some sort of abdominal surgery and they need to be – what is the way in which they would be, closed up prior to this invention?
Right. So, yeah, so the topical adhesives, cyanoacrylate is the technical name for those. You see those – they're pretty prevalent if you have kids. If you've ever been to an ER and they have a small cut and they don't want to use traditional sutures, they'll use this topical adhesive. And it sloughs off after a few days, and it keeps the ends of the wound together. What they use other for internal, they haven't had an adhesive. So what they use is things like fiber and sealants, which are a hemostat, like it prevents small blood vessels from you know, leaking and so forth. Our product's not intended to help with the closure per se, meaning, you know, replace sutures. What we're doing is we're gluing planes of tissue, big flaps of tissue together. And really what our FDA approval is, we can eliminate the need for post-surgical drains or the drains that are sticking outside of your body after surgery. So it's a unique indication, and it's something that could be used pretty much in over about 1.2 million procedures right now in the U.S.
And if we have we explained how it works?
Let me explain that to you. So it's really drops of adhesive that are placed inside the body with our applicator, and it allows the planes of tissue or the big flaps to be held in place. And what that does is everywhere there's not a piece of tissue glue, there's just the natural tissue-to-tissue contact. And the body heals usually in 4 to 5 days. You see the collagen growth and the natural growth. So our product basically takes these big open spaces inside your body and closes them naturally.
And where does what happens to the glue or the residue of that?
Sure. Well, one of our co-founders, Eric Beckman, Dr. Beckman from the University of Pittsburgh, was the creator of this along with Dr. Michael Buckley. And the unique part is they took a really strong acting adhesive, kind of like Gorilla Glue or Elmer's glue kind of stuff, took all the bad bits out and basically made it from natural amino acids inside the body. It breaks down into sugar and water, and then it dissolves. So in about a year, year and a half, it's completely gone.
So how might hospitals benefit from this new technology?
Well, hospitals and patients. So let's take the hospital side. So right now, traditionally, you go in for a various amount of surgeries. You have these drains that are protruding from your body. Those are in anywhere from 7 to 10 days. Could be as long as 2 or 3 weeks. It requires a healthcare professional either to monitor those or the patient to monitor those. And then you get a certain amount of those patients have them in for longer than expected, and they still get a continued fluid buildup. How that helps the hospital system is you put our product in, and we've proven through a clinical trial with the FDA that 75% of those patients never come back into the healthcare system, never need to see a doctor again. So if you have a surgery on a Monday, you go home on Tuesday, you have no drains, you'll never have to go see the doctor to manage any of that post-operative complications that could occur with drains.
And what were some of the challenges that you faced in developing this?
Well, I kind of look at that as a two-part question. So there's the development of the technical product, and there's the development of the company. So how would you like me to go?
Well,
I can go on both.
I think people are interested in the – I mean, clearly there's a business side of this, and there's money to be made.
Sure.
But I think from the standpoint of people listening to this and wondering, you know, how it may one day impact their lives in terms of developing this product – I'm sure there's all sorts of hurdles, the FDA approval, things that, you know, you have to do and that you've been working on for years. So just describe how, you know, this happens. Mm-hmm. Some other budding entrepreneurs might be interested as well.
No, it's a great question. So I think the biggest hurdle is three things. There's time, there's the approval process, and then there's money. So the time piece is you got to develop the product correctly to start. You got to have what's considered a substantial market that will support that product. I think the most difficult part is if you're taking something like ours, which is a unique device, and you have to go through the FDA, there are three classes of a product. And so if you're a unique product like ours, you have to go through the most difficult process, which can take anywhere from 7 to 15 years. So there is a lot of preclinical tests, biocompatibility, design control, your clinical trials. All that has to be reviewed, and we're proud to say that in 2014, there were over 4,500 products that went through the FDA medical devices. Only 29 were approved that were the class 3, the most difficult process. Of those 29, only 7 went to a panel review of outside experts. So we were one of only 7. So a very rigorous approval process.
And now that you've obtained FDA approval, what's the next step towards making tissue glue more widely available?
Sure. We've done two things. One, in January, we announced a sales distribution agreement with a company called B. Braun in Europe, and that's going to really help us get our exposure more broadly in Europe. And then in the U.S., we're going to have to commercialize that here. So we're going to have to develop a sales and marketing organization and get that out. We're going to start small, probably go 5 to 10 different cities and then expand from there. That's been kind of lately the traditional way of doing that.
And, you know, what kind of, you know, in terms of in financial impact and industrial impact, you know, what are we talking about here?
The impact to the patient or to?
To your business.
Oh. Well, you know, this is a technology that is close to a $1 billion market that no one's ever played in. So for us, we have to execute the sales launch properly and make sure that we get it out with what's called the key opinion leaders, have really good success in the beginning, and then grow that across the country.
And what kind of job opportunities you're going to have to hire a staff of people, I would imagine. So what kind of impact could this have on the broader Pittsburgh Eds and Meds economy?
Yeah, so I think the impact we've had so far, we have about 22 employees, very good paying engineering positions. We've been very heavily R&D focused. Where that's going to shift now is going to be into a sales and marketing focus. But the fact that we have products going out to the general public now through the FDA approval means we have to have regulatory and clinical people that are brought on board. So for us, we're going to see a pretty healthy growth in the next 6 to 12 months. And then depending on how the launch goes, that's going to be exponentially larger just depending on sales.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with the president and CEO of Cohera Medical, Patrick Daly. His company has created a new internal surgical adhesive, and it is something that could potentially revolutionize at least some aspect of the medical field. Could tissue glue have other applications outside of abdominal surgery or even outside of the medical field?
Well, that's a great question. So let's take outside of abdominal surgery. So abdominal surgery is around anywhere from about 200,000 to 300,000 procedures a year. We've already proven in Europe, in particular Germany, that you can do no-drain mastectomies. So these are patients, women that come in that have already had a cancer surgery, and they're dealing with that drain for weeks post-surgically. So we've got a really nice clinical trial that's been going on. We're about 90 patients into that. That shows you don't need drains for that. We're going to work with FDA. We got the indication for use based on what our U.S. clinical study was. But we have already seen this in, for example, the mastectomy cases I mentioned, a particular procedure for cancer called inguinal node dissection. So a patient presents with cancer. They do a very large incision on the upper part of the leg and take out those nodes. What's been really fun to watch for us is that the doctors have shown a 30% reduction in infection rates and about a 33% reduction in reoperation rates when they use tissue glue in those cases because they can't start the chemotherapy or interferon or any other regimen until the surgical procedure is completed. And completion means that the patient's been fully healed and that there's no wound issues. So we're excited. There's a whole host. There's cardiovascular procedures. I can spout off a bunch of technical names, but yeah, we're excited. As we work with FDA, we see this, you know, we're going to do it the right way, and we're going to work with them and get this out in the hands of way more doctors.
And what kind of inquiries are you getting already for this?
Well, you know, our website, when the press release came out with our approval, we received quite a few in the first week or so. You know, patients and doctors saying, hey, look, I'm thinking of having this surgery, and what's held me back is I've talked to my friend down the street, and when I do this procedure, or she did it, or he did it, the drains were in. The doctor said 2 or 3 days. They were in for 3 weeks. I have two kids and a job. I can't be off that long. So we're getting a lot of inquiries. We just got to manage that the right way because we don't want to have this in the hands of folks that, you know, A, don't know about it, or, you know, haven't been trained by one of our reps once we get out in the field. So that's – we're going to keep the excitement up, but we want to make sure we do this the right way.
And what kind of other products possibly are you currently in development with?
Well, we have a whole host, but I think the one we're most excited about, we're in the what they call the CE marking process, which is approval for Europe. And it's a product called Silas, and that is a bowel sealant. So right now, traditionally, a patient goes in and has cancer or may have a benign tumor and they have to have part of their bowel removed or any procedure like that. They traditionally now use a staple gun or sutures. there is a certain leak rate that is associated with that, and that leak rate is very onerous because if you have the contents of your bowel leaking into your abdominal cavity, it's either a reoperation or the patient's very sick for a long time. We've developed a product that while some of the products are, or the contents are based off the tissue glue platform, this is a product that is gone in 90 days that goes around the staple or suture line. And we've shown in our animal studies that it reduces leaks by up to 70%. So we're very excited about that. And that's a game changer, not only for the patient, but for the hospital system as well, because those reoperations are very expensive.
We've been talking with Patrick Daly. He is the president and CEO of Cohera Medical, talking about their new internal surgical adhesive and other products they are developing. Patrick, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for recognizing the company. Really appreciate it.
Coming up, a Point Park professor has suggestions for chasing the winter blues away. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Have the bone-chilling temperatures been bringing you down, keeping you indoors? Are you eating too much comfort food, binge-watching programs to help you deal with the winter? Well, if that's the case, we might have some answers for your situation, things that could help you. Joining us with tips to help combat the winter blues is Point Park University Humanities and Human Sciences Professor Brent Robbins. Brent Robbins, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me, Paul. It's great to be here.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can tweet a question at esspgh. What are you doing to combat the winter blues? How have you been managing to get through these cold, cold days, the darkness, the cabin fever, all of that? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. And Brent Robbins, as we begin this conversation, let's talk about how you define the winter blues, because there are the clinical things like SAD, situational affective disorder. Is that what we're talking about here, or is it something else?
Well, seasonal affective disorder is a real condition that people have where during the winter months they develop a clinical depression, which has a variety of different symptoms. They start to feel sad much of the day, nearly every day. They may have disruptions in their sleep. They may have insomnia, or they may be sleeping too much. There may be low energy. There may be even thoughts of suicide. You can see some very serious cases of winter depression. But then there's sort of a non-clinical type of melancholy that I think is really commonly comes over people during the winter months. So you might say that there's a kind of winter blues. It's not something you need to worry about. You might not need to see a doctor about, but might worry people because they're noticing a change in their mood. I think it's important to distinguish between those two different states of mind. I think it's wonderful to live in a place like Pittsburgh where we get all four seasons. And one of the things I love about all four seasons is each season has its own mood, right? So, you know, it's fall, you know, it's a time to sort of reap the harvest of what we've accomplished. It's a time of there's a lot of time that we celebrate what we've accomplished over the year. Winter season is much more of a melancholy period of time where people sort of get self-reflective and turn more inward. They're not active and out in the streets so much. But along with that comes, I think, an opportunity to self-reflect, to think about what we want to accomplish, what we have accomplished so far, changes in goals. And so I think we can sort of take advantage of that melancholy mood and use it to our own benefit. So I think that's important to distinguish from something that's a more serious clinical disorder.
So what you're saying is that at this time of the year, we have this opportunity to reflect on ourselves, maybe look inward, redefine our goals, maybe question what we're all about. And that comes from just the atmosphere of more darkness, of of the outdoors not being as inviting, so you're liable to maybe sit still longer than you might in the summer, where you're rushing to get your tennis racket and get off to the tennis court or the playground, or you know, out for a run or whatever it may be.
That's right. So it's just the weather lends itself to a particular kind of mood, and that mood of melancholy lends itself to potentially very constructive activities, being self-reflective, thinking about your goals, thinking about things you might want to change. You can go through a period that's sort of like, you know, the snake changing his skin or her skin, where you're molting like insects do. You know, you shed your ego and your past self, and you transform it for a new self. You know, I think winter's a great time to do that. Even if you look around at different cultures, different religions, you'll notice that around this time of year, in February in particular, you'll see there's kind of built-in rituals for people to self-reflect and to think about who they are and where they're going and where they've been and what they want to do. And it's an opportunity to renew your values and your goals, or to change them.
And therein may lie the question, what is your winter ritual? We'd like to hear about it. 412-246-2002. You can share that with us. 412-246-2002 to join the conversation with Brent Robbins, who is a Point Park University Humanities and Human Sciences professor. A lot of people study in this field, but you've sort of set your sights on this aspect of the kind of seasonal reflectiveness, the things that we might do at this time of year. What got you going in that direction, Brent?
Well, what got me going in that direction is I think that it's very common for those in my field of clinical psychology to look at what we perceive as negative moods like sadness and anxiety and to see them rush to seeing them as diseases. And sometimes they are very serious diseases. They're signs of some kind of underlying mental illness. But a lot of times they're not. I mean, we've evolved as species to have a wide variety of emotions that serve important functions. You know, and if we weren't afraid, for example, we wouldn't survive for very long. We'd die very quickly. You know, we'd be jumping off of cliffs and into the mouths of lions. So we've evolved to have fear because it serves an important function. We have pain because pain tells us something's wrong and we need to deal with it. And I think sadness is like that. Sadness and melancholy is sometimes a sign of serious illness, but sometimes it's a normal human emotion that's really about letting go of something. It's about dealing with loss. It's about dealing with personal transformation. And it's a healthy, normal thing to go through.
And you have these steps that you've suggested for people. And one of the things you talk about is taking action to find joy,
right?
When winter hits its deepest points, and I think we're at that deep point. You know, we're well past the holidays. You know, the frosty, the snowy tree branches don't look as good to us.
That's right.
You know, we pretty much had it with slogging through the snow, even though we really haven't had that much, relatively speaking. You know, a lot of disgruntled snow shovelers I noticed on Saturday as the stuff was falling from the sky. People getting tired of that, tired of the icy roads, and tired of walking outdoors and sort of being slapped in the face by that brisk cold air. So you're saying in the midst of all that is this joy. Where is the joy to be found?
Well, like I said, there's this opportunity to in a sort of state of melancholy and in this period of self-reflection to take some great joy in that, to sort of have a glass half full kind of approach to that. But I think there's also some things that we can do to sort of protect ourselves from that melancholy becoming something more serious. And I think one of the things is just to get outside a little bit more often, dress up for the cold, you know, protect yourself from the elements. You might want to stay in when it's, you know, 30 below degree wind chills. But when it's, you know, when it's safe enough to go out, engaging in more aerobic activity can be really helpful. Getting exposure to sunlight and also watching your health, I think, are all ways of keeping yourself protected and able to cope with the kinds of stresses that come with this time of year. So keeping yourself healthy by what you eat. You can replace refined sweets and carbohydrates with, you know, fresh fruits and crunchy vegetables and
put down the meatloaf.
Yeah, right.
Get out of the macaroni and cheese. And you know, eat as if the weather were warmer, because you can't just do the things that seem to make sense for winter, like eating heavier foods.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, there's a real strong pull to eat sort of comfort foods, high carbohydrate, high fat.
Don't
high
I
sugar.
Know it? Don't I know it?
Me too. Me too. And a lot of fish is very good to be eating. Whole grains. You know, if you're eating a lot of fish, you're going to get omega-3 fatty acids, which are really important for the brain, keeping your brain healthy and functioning. You're going to get higher B6 vitamins, which enhances brain functioning, helps the body convert food to fuel, your carbohydrates transforming into energy. Chicken, legumes, bananas, avocados, dark green leafy vegetables, those are all great things to be eating this time of year. Spinach, broccoli, orange juice, and chard will give you that folic acid that gives you that, your brain, a lot of resiliency. And high fiber, like with whole grains, helps you digest and regulate your metabolism, which has a positive effect on your mood, helps you have a more stable mood.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation with Brent Robbins of Point Park University. Let's go to LaDonna in Pittsburgh. Hi, LaDonna. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and thank you for being there.
It's our pleasure.
Nice to – hello, Donna.
Yes.
Go ahead with your comment or question.
Well, I wanted to speak to the point of using a commercial light box. I had never suffered from anything like winter blues when I lived in the Midwest, but I started suffering from it when I moved to Pittsburgh, and it hadn't even been discovered at that time. But over the years, it was, and I did some work with Norman Rosenthal, who suffered from winter blues as a result of moving to this country from South Africa. And anyway, to make a long story short, one alternative, especially for living in Pittsburgh, is to look at a commercial light box like the Sunbox Company, which you can Google that company. There are others now, but this was the first company, and it's the one that Norman Rosenthal, the discoverer of winter blues, uses himself. And you can either sit in front of it for a period of time, a half an hour or so, or just put it in a high space and let it give extra light.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that a therapeutic light box can be extremely helpful for people who are suffering from seasonal affective disorder, SAD. And even people who are dealing with sort of winter melancholy can benefit from more sunlight, getting outside. It's not going to work if you're inside your house. You're not going to get the vitamin D that you need from the sunlight that's going to help your mood if you're just sitting in front of a window. You need to get out there, bundle up, and also get some aerobic exercise. You know, when you combine aerobic exercise with more sunlight, you're getting a lot of benefits. You're getting a release of endorphins, which is going to help boost your mood and help. It's therapeutic for covering over pain and helping you cope with things like stress, anxiety, and depression. It's going to boost your self-esteem because if you're exercising, you're going to have more energy. Your sleep's going to be better. You're going to look better and feel better about yourself. And then with the sunlight, you're getting vitamin D, which acts on areas of the brain which are linked to depression. It's vitamin D is a steroid hormone precursor, and about a quarter of the population is deficient in vitamin D, and it's especially a problem during the winter. So getting more sunlight, and if it's serious, like a seasonal affective disorder, then a therapeutic light box can give you a higher dose of sunlight when it's not available during the winter.
At what point should you be worried? I mean, you've said that a winter-based melancholy is not something to be concerned about. It's a natural thing, and shouldn't really interfere with our ability to function day to day. But is there a point at which you really have to be concerned? And what are the signs?
Yeah, I would say some of the signs to look for are. Is there a change in appetite? Are you eating more than you normally would and gaining weight? Are you losing weight and eating less than you normally would? Are you having difficulty getting to sleep, waking up in the middle of the night and having difficulty going back to sleep? Is there dysfunction? Are you finding it difficult to get motivated, to get out of bed, to do the things you need to do at home and at work? If you start to see dysfunction, like you can't take care of yourself, or take care of other people that you're obligated to take care of, like your children, if you start to see that things are falling apart, then that is a really good sign that something more serious is going on and you really should get some kind of professional help at that point.
LaDonna, thank you for that phone call. And if you would like to join the conversation, we have plenty of time left for questions, 412-246-2002. 2002, the number to call to join our conversation here on Essential Pittsburgh with Brent Robbins. He is Point Park University Humanities and Human Sciences professor. And one of the things that I've talked to people about is it seems so comforting. You know, you talk about comfort foods, but there's also that just that idea of being comfortable on the couch and not wanting to get off of it, especially when you look out the window. It looks so foreboding. But is there sort of a kind of a mind over matter approach to, as you say, getting out there and moving around, that is really the beneficial thing, as long as it's not, you know, terribly cold with a wind chill that would, you know, put you in danger of frostbite,
right,
or that kind of thing, or if you have asthma. But if you're just somebody who's sitting on the couch who's just gotten into this pattern of not wanting to move, is part of it just taking that first step and realizing it's not that bad? And then once you get out there, you might say to yourself, why didn't I do this sooner?
Yeah, I think that if you get out there and, you know, take a walk in the woods, natural settings in particular can really boost the mood. There's been research done on that. When people just take a walk in the woods, it can have an enormous boost on somebody's mood. And it can lift, you know, more milder cases of depression. So you're getting the aerobic exercise in the sunlight, but also just taking in the natural world, the smells and sounds can liven the senses and bring people back to a state where they're feeling like they're not dead, you know, sitting around just watching TV. And it gets the blood flowing and increases that sense of vitality that comes with aerobic exercise.
Have you had people come to you and say, you know, I had a hard time getting out there, and once I did, I felt so much better. I thought to myself, why didn't I do this sooner?
Yeah, all the time. Yeah, there's been I hear that all the time from patients. I hear it from friends, and I hear it from the research. Research shows that actually exercise, and particularly exercise outdoors, actually can be just as beneficial, if not more beneficial, than medications or psychotherapy. And there's no side effects.
So the guys I get together with Thursday nights at Schenley Park, I mean, there's some nights we're there, it's so cold you can't even feel your feet. And I've begun to question my sanity, but that you're saying that's fine to do.
It's an incredibly healthy thing to do for yourself. Not only are you getting the exercise in that case, but you're also getting the social interaction.
Yes, so, right, exactly. You're getting together with other people with similar interests, which makes a difference. Let's go to Lynn in Highland Park. Lynn, hi, you're on the air with Brent Robbins.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm a horticulturalist, and one of the things we do as soon as the weather turns nasty is to order all the seed catalogs and flower catalogs, you know, for the next year. And when November and December and January and February roll around, one of the things I do is to visualize the garden projects that I'm working on for the next year. So even though I'm not physically outside, I'm mentally outside.
Mm.
And I think that visualization, you know, can do a lot to lift your spirits, because you have something to look forward to.
I think that's wonderful. I think that's an example of what I'm talking about that comes with this kind of melancholy, is that it's a call to begin to think about what's coming next in the spring. And spring, you have this sort of renewal, this new life that comes. And what you're doing as an activity is a great metaphor for what, even if you're not into horticulture, it's a nice metaphor for what we're all going through in winter, is anticipating that new, the new renewal of the self that happens in the spring, and that new vitality that comes, and a new sense of hope, and an opportunity to accomplish new things that comes when the weather lifts.
Thank you so much for that call, Lynn. So, yes, you can just mentally put yourself in another place, if not physically, to get yourself through the cold weather season.
Yeah, visualizing can be very powerful. And also just how we think about things, right? You know, how we think about things, looking at the positive side instead of the negative, thinking about thinking more optimistically, and getting in the habits of doing that is always going to be protective when it comes to depression as well.
Our guest has been Brent Robbins, Point Park University Humanities and Human Sciences professor, talking about beating the winter blues. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Paul. It's been great to be here.
Thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Tomorrow we'll meet a 95-year-old World War II veteran who was a radio operator in the last days of the war in Germany. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.